Hello everybody, I'm Matt Wolford, and this is Trium Connects.
A lot of the material that's written about innovation comes from entrepreneurs, people who work in startups, people who teach entrepreneurship. We're strategy professors, and so we're more coming from this angle of how do established firms do this. And so I think there is this tension in established firms where we pressure, we say we need to innovate, but then let's be profitable because we measure it with the same KPIs as existing business. And this is not going to work. How do you build this organization that is ambidextrous, that does exploitation and exploration? Because if you only focus on exploitation, you're not preparing for the future.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 32 of Trium Connects. My guest for this episode is Laurence Lehmann-Ortega. Laurence is one of the world's experts in how existing firms can create innovative new business models. In this episode, we discuss the newest edition of her book, Reinventing Your Business Model, the Odyssey 3.14 Approach, which she co-authored with Hélène Musicas and Jean-Marc Schkortel. The book has been also adapted into a MOOC by Coursera. Like many of the best business school teachers, Laurence started her career in the consulting world before transitioning into academia, first at GSCM in Montpellier, and then from 2010 at HEC Paris. At HEC, she teaches strategy and business model innovation in the master's program, the MBA, EMBA, and in customized executive education programs, and has won multiple teaching awards in her time there. Laurence is also the academic director of the Masters of Strategic Management and our very own Trium EMBA program. In addition, she is the academic director on a number of large and complex programs in HEC's custom executive education portfolio. In this episode of Trium Connects, we discuss the problems of alignment between business models, value propositions, and the existing firm's value architecture. We see that if that alignment isn't there, no matter how good the business model value proposition is, it's unlikely to be successful. We also talk about the challenge of the trade-offs across different values when measuring the impact of a business model. It is often very difficult to make the trade-offs between profit, people, and planet when evaluating the contribution new business models will make to a firm's goals. We talk about how to tell if a firm has a healthy innovation culture and the need for proper scientific testing when doing innovation. And finally, we have briefly discussed the problem of applying simple ROI metrics to innovation spending. Finally, we finished the discussion with a short conversation on the executive education industry itself. You know, Laurence and I are both on the supply side of this business. That is, we put together content for degree and non-degree programs. Here, we try to put ourselves onto the buy side and discuss what we would look for if we were making the decision as an individual to spend time and money on our own learning and development, and what we would look for if we were a corporate client looking to partner with a business school in executive education. Laurence is one of the most talented teachers and academic directors I've ever met. I always look forward to our conversations because I always walk away feeling like I've learned something, and this conversation is no exception. And now, without any further ado, I bring you my conversation with Laurence Lehmann-Ortega. Laurence Lehmann-Ortega, welcome to Trium Connects.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
It's a pleasure. You know, you and I have been working together for quite some time, and it's absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. I want to just jump right into things because, you know, you've released a revised edition of a cherished book that's been out there for a while. But let me start with saying a little bit of a reflection about the business you and I are in. So one of the things I think almost every company that I've ever worked with wants to develop more of is better leaders and more innovation.
That's true.
And over, that's what I hear. So, and the importance of these topics, because it's so common, have generated a completely huge industry to answer or to try to answer the question of how do I get better at that? Right? Whether it's leadership or innovation. And, You and your colleagues at HEC, Hélène Musicas and Jean-Marc, is it Schurti? Am I pronouncing that right?
Schuttle, but you can...
Schuttle, oh, I'm sorry. I get troubles with that sometimes, but Schuttle. You jumped into this kind of river of product and content by writing a book entitled Reinventing Your Business Model with the Odyssey 3.14 Approach. And I think that was first published, the first edition was in 2014. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
And now, in about what, two months, the newest edition of this, the third edition, will come out.
Yes, end of May 2020.
End of May. So get your pre-orders in, everybody out there. This is a plug for the book. But it is a really interesting book. I've enjoyed using it, listening to you teach it, and reading it since it came out. And one of the things I love about it, and we're going to talk about this, is the wealth of examples from real companies that you use to illustrate the different elements of the framework and your thinking about business model innovation. And it just really makes the content pop out in a really incredible way. And given the fact that it's going into its third edition, that says something about not only the quality of the work, but also the longevity of the ideas. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But before we go into the framework, because I do want to do that, but I just was wondering, as I was looking at this third edition, what was your original motivation in writing it? I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, and everybody probably has their favorite innovation book, but you must have come to a point where you looked out across this universe of material and you thought, there's something missing here. There's something that I don't think is being captured. What do you think is missing? What do you think was missing out there when you wrote this book?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. So when I joined HEC in 2009 and I met Hélène Musicas there, we were teaching strategy. And so we're strategy professors teaching strategy. And, you know, in strategy, we have a lot of tools to analyze the industry. Porter's Five Forces, Pistel, that are very well established, that everybody knows, but we're still teaching them, getting our students and participants to understand why those tools are helpful, why you need to analyze the environment. And then you just tell them, and then you come up with an innovative strategy, or then you come up with a strategy. And of course, you have those typologies of strategies, you know, high-end, low-end, low-cost strategies, and you describe them. But basically, you just tell them, you come up with a strategy. And this is where we were figuring out with Hélène, we were thinking, how can we provide a tool that would help our students and participants in executive education to come up with more innovative business ideas or more innovative strategies. And this is where we come from. I think a lot of the material that's written about innovation comes from entrepreneurs, people who work in startups, people who teach entrepreneurship. We're strategy professors. And so we're more coming from this angle of how do established firms do this? How does an established firm tackle this issue? And this is why we came up with this. And for us, our personal learning style is to go out there and to see how companies actually do it. And this is how we collected all those examples. And this is why our teaching is about examples, why our book is around examples of companies that have actually applied and this way of thinking and come up with different innovative strategies. So this is where it came from originally.
So super interesting. So one of the gaps that you thought were out there was just books to help existing firms, which often find it much more difficult. So when I read innovation books, often they seem to be pitched to people trying to found a business, or if they aren't going to found a business, they say how to act like a founder within an existing company, which is a pretty hard thing to do, don't you think?
I fully agree. It's very difficult because the conditions are very different. And that's one of the challenges of innovation in established firms, as we will probably discuss later.
Yes, we will. But that's interesting. So it's for established firms, and it really was from the beginning. You didn't come up with a framework necessarily and then look for examples of this out there, but this was like, we've seen this stuff out there. We kind of know what's working, what's not working. Let's try to kind of integrate that into a unified approach. Do I get that right?
Exactly. So what we've done over the years is collecting a lot of examples for our teaching, but also In my PhD dissertation that was about business model reinvention, I from the start targeted established firms and looked at how established firms, bigger ones, smaller ones, are doing, but never from the startup angle, but always from the established firms angle. And again, I've collected with Hélène so many examples to illustrate our course. And then one day we just thought, you know, we need to frame this in a particular way. Let's analyze all the examples we have and try to see if we can come up with a kind of pattern that could be then helpful for other companies to use. And this is how we came up with the approach, actually, and framing them into 14 different directions that are ways for people to get ideas of how they could reinvent their business model, but also maybe invent a completely new business model from the start.
The approach is called this 3.14 approach. This does not mean it's the 14th iteration of the third version of the approach, but it refers to what you call three pillars. And then off these three pillars, you have seven directions for each of two pillars, and then one pillar that's called contribution. So let's start with the pillars. So let's build up this model a little bit so people can understand your approach. So let's start with a blank page. And in the middle of the page, we put three kind of sections or three pillars. One is the value proposition. One's the value architecture. And then something that you call contributions. So value proposition maybe is pretty straightforward, but what do we mean by the value architecture and contributions?
Value proposition indeed describes what the company is offering to their customer, who the customers are, and what the company is offering. So that's the value proposition. And as you said, pretty straightforward. What the value architecture depicts is how the companies are doing it. That is, how do they deliver this product or service in due time to the customer? So that's, of course, refers to the value chain or the supply chain, as we usually call it in companies, but we call it the value architecture just to show that it's broader than the value chain. It also is how you connect with your partners, with your suppliers, with your distribution network, and also the competencies that you're actually using and leveraging in order to develop this, to develop and to deliver this value proposition. So that's the value architecture part. And very often what I tell when I teach around this is that it shows also what strategy is in companies. A way to think about strategy is when you look at value proposition, who is in charge of the value proposition in an organization? It's the marketing team, right? The salespeople and the marketing team. What's the ultimate dream of a marketer? The ultimate dream, I would argue, of course, serve their customers and so on. But if we kind of oversimplify here, the marketers, they would always love to have a unique product for each unique customer because, you know, yeah, they will tell you, my customer is unique, so I need to have the completely customized product. On the other hand, who is in charge of value architecture in companies? And of course, it's operations, right? Mm. And what's the ultimate dream of people in operations? If I oversimplify here, of course, it's standardization. They want to have one product because this makes their life so much easier, right? Yeah. And one of the things of strategy is to have a common goal, an understanding on the two parts of this of the organization to tell them, to tell the marketeers, sorry guys, but we need to compromise. There can't be one product per customer. And on the other side, to operations, we know that this introduces some complexity, but you know, this is why we're doing it. And strategy is also about making sure that those two parts of the organization understand that they need to, you know, push for the same goal. Mm. And so what I like in this business model framework is that value proposition and value architecture need to be aligned in order to generate what we call, and that's our third pillar, the contributions. And so let me just come back to our previous versions of the book where we call this the profit equation. And the idea of the profit equation was to say you can only generate a profit if the value proposition and the value architecture are aligned. That is, again, here I'm oversimplifying for the sake of the exercise here, but if you can decide about your prices tomorrow, you can lower your prices by 25% tomorrow. That's not a problem. Lowering your costs by 25% tomorrow morning is much more difficult. And so you need to have a consistency between the value proposition and the value architecture in order to achieve a profit.
So let me just pick up on that before we get to contributions, because I really want to get to that. But I thought it was interesting because it's this idea of alignment, which is interesting. So if I get it right, the architecture is in some ways a constraint on what kind of value proposition can be offered. So if we go back again to the real world examples, I see a lot of companies that come up with really innovative ideas. This would be a great business model, and they try to implement it, but their value architecture is completely disaligned with what they're trying to do from this great idea. And so you get sometimes companies saying, oh, well, let's say the automotive company. So we're switching from being an automotive company to a mobility company. And here's a value proposition for us as a mobility company. Just doesn't match at all the value architecture of the company, or an energy company. We're no longer an oil and gas company. We're an energy company. So let's do this, which is correct in the strategic sense. This is where a value is, but it doesn't fit at all with the architecture. Do I get that right?
Exactly. They need to reinvent their value architecture. And this is exactly why many companies are failing to go, many established companies who see the opportunity of going into low-cost businesses, for example, they realize that they can't do it because they don't have the right value architecture. The typical example are airlines, you know, all those airlines, those established airlines who try to go into low-cost airlines, they realize that they just didn't have the right value architecture. And it's not only about, you know, the processes, it's also about the culture. And the dominant logic that the people are in. If you are a conventional airline company, you are into services, you are into making sure that your business class customers are happy and so on. And it's very difficult to bring a culture and a value architecture that would actually be low cost.
My experience is if you look for failure at innovation, it's almost never on the kind of quality of the idea, on the value proposition. It's almost always on problems with the aligning that with the architecture.
I fully agree. And, you know, I think the word that you said, alignment, is one of my favorite words in strategy, because I think if you don't have this alignment, then it's just not going to happen.
Okay, so tell me how and why you went from the profit equation to this new category, or at least a new title of the category called contributions. What happened there?
When we were thinking about the business model framework, so with the three pillars, the value proposition, value architecture, profit equation, the objective of strategy is to improve your profitability overall. And so it was very much aligned with this idea of how can I invent a business model or reinvent my business model in order to improve my profitability. But more and more now, when we think about the objective of a firm, we understand that it's not only about profitability, and it's also about what's the purpose of the organization behind generating a profit. And I'm not saying profit is not important. We all know that if there is no profit, your company is not going to be sustainable in the sense it's not going to last very long. So we need to have this profitability, but for the same reason, you know, I really like this image. For the same reason, I don't live to eat, but I eat to live. For the same reason, I need to generate a profit. But the question is, what do I want to do with this profit? What is my objective? What is the objective, the purpose? You know, in French, we say the raison d'être of our organization. And when we were starting to teach around those ideas, we were thinking, oh, but then our framework is not really aligned with this, because at no point in the framework, we actually challenge we actually show how this business model is contributing to this purpose. And this is where we came up with this idea of contribution. It means that beyond the profit, and again, I insist on this, the profit is very important, but how does my business model contribute to environmental issues, and how does my business model contribute to societal issues? And so now we formulated, it's still in the three pillars, but indeed this last pillar is not only about profitability, but it's also about contribution to profit, people, planet, basically to the three P's. It's, you need the profit, but the profit should be there to contribute to solve our societal and environmental issues that we're facing today.
So I largely agree, and I love the approach, but let me just play the devil's advocate for a second, because I think that you address this in the book in a really interesting way. So as long as we score our performance by profit, it's relatively easy to make decisions, right? This is going to go to more profit. This is going to go to less profit. And we, you know, it's kind of like, it doesn't mean that there's not risk involved or uncertainty, but we have a metric on which to help us decide what we should do. Now, as soon as you put in other dimensions of the contribution, we kind of lose a metric in which we can say, what's the best thing to do here? Now, I get so tired of reading things in this area that says, oh, well, if we just do the right thing, we'll be more profitable. It might take us longer, but... And so one way around this problem of not having a metric is just pretend like everything is maximizing profit. All the things we want to do for doing right is the same as maximizing profit. And if we look at it over the long enough term, we're going to be fine. So the reason that we don't do bad things is because it's a risk mitigation strategy. So when regulations change, we'll be ready. We won't have to change our operations, and our profit in the long term will go up, et cetera. Now, what's hard is to face the fact that that's not the case, that we make hugely difficult trade-offs, and we no longer have a metric that we can say this is best because of the following. And what you guys do in the book, I think, is really interesting, because you don't duck that question. You don't say, oh, I'm not going to address that question. So you set up some kind of interesting examples of trade-offs. So environmental versus societal trade-offs, or long versus short-term, which are kind of what we were talking about on the profit side. And then also global versus local. I wonder if you could give our listeners just a little bit of an example of what you were thinking about here, and what are some of these examples of the trade-offs that you find particularly tricky?
That's a very interesting question, Matt, as always. And I think I fully agree with you, this idea today that what you read is basically either, okay, let's focus on profit on one hand, or let's be good on the other hand, because if we're good, this will eventually show. And I agree that this is kind of la la land, right? The problem with environmental and social objectives is that they're very often contradictory, and that you can be indeed good on one side and not good on the other side. And as always, strategy is about trade-offs, and this will be here another trade-off. Just to go back to your idea also of measuring, and then I will answer your question, but the idea of measuring, this is exactly what holds back company on those issues, because we don't have tools to measure. And a lot of companies are saying, oh, we don't have tools, so we don't measure. And there is actually one thing where companies have started to... are more engaged in, which is decarbonization strategies. Why are they more engaged into decarbonization? Because there are a lot of other issues on that besides carbon emissions. But why are companies overall more engaged in this issue is just because we have a metric, because we have a common currency, which is the equivalent ton of CO2. This is why companies are doing this first, because they have a tool that they can use. There are still a lot of measurement challenges, but this is what they do. So when it comes to measuring other things, how do you measure biodiversity? How do you measure engagement at work? How do you measure fair share of value? So those are all the things that are so difficult to measure. And I fully agree that what we said is we would need to measure this, but we're not there yet where we have specific tools to offer to companies.
I think even if we got a way to measure it, because they're in different things, then we have a chunk to... So let me give you an example. Cobalt extraction from the DRC, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, is an incredibly nasty business. It has child labor throughout all of the supply chain. It is bad, right? There is horrible things going on in that supply chain. We need cobalt for our batteries. So if a company says, okay, how much profit should I sacrifice to make sure that there's no child labor in my cobalt supply? Okay, so they have this as a trade-off, right? So you have two values. So what is one child labor worth in profit? Because that's where it becomes difficult. Because even if we can measure the worth in some, this is the number of disutilities or bad units of moral something that are involved in child labor, how do you convert that to money?
Exactly. That's a real question. And as soon as you touch, I think you can do this when you think about carbon emissions, right? But as soon as you touch to things that are linked to human and to lives and to people, it's becoming much trickier. And do you really want to say how much a life is worth, or
exactly,
do you really want to measure this? Exactly. So and so the measurement issue is still there, and I think we're not there yet. But you know, I would argue that even for financial measurements, it took us 70 years to get to the point where now we have standards, especially in Europe and in the US, right? So this will take time. And there will always be this question of, can you actually measure, can you actually give a financial value to the life of people? But at least we will try to have a common way of measuring it in the years to come. I think there's a lot of effort put into this.
Okay, so that's with profit on one side. So we know that there it's hard. How about when we have two kind of more qualitative elements against each other? So you give this example of global versus local concerns. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's just as an example of conflicts between things that are not profit oriented.
One example we gave in the book is there are a lot of super nice examples of very small scale organic farms that are very respectful of the environment, you know, that grow the crop with regenerative agriculture, very conscious on the local dimension. And they're very, generally, they're very good also for the local communities because they include the local ecosystem, the local communities. I think about examples in Africa where you really see this. But on the other hand, this, if you look at it from a global standpoint, from a food supply standpoint, that's a suboptimal solution if we look at it from a global standpoint where we need to feed 8 billion people, right? So this solution that looks really good on the local standpoint, from a local standpoint, is not very good from a global one. And it would be much better to have still regenerative agriculture, but on a larger scale, rather than having those really small scale farmers that develop throughout Africa. So this would be an example of a trade-off, you know, what do you promote? Do you promote very local agriculture or something more? Do you reinvent agriculture to have a more productive, regenerative agriculture?
I commend the book because instead of ducking these questions, they do try to address them with all of the shortcomings on measurement. And I hope you're right that in the next 40 or 50 years, I mean, maybe we can't wait that long, but I hope that we get some way to measure these. But I think inherently, once you get out of a single profit dimension, then you start to get really tricky because who gets to decide that? Who gets to decide whether my local concerns are more important than the global ones? And these become value proposition or value conflicts that different people can have completely different points of view. And then inherently, this pushes the firm into a political dimension.
When you look at those questions, you also take into account governance because you can't, you know, you very often end up thinking about, okay, how do we make those decisions? Who takes this decision? And then you end up in questioning the governance structure of your company.
Which always makes me a little bit nervous when we say what we're going to rely on in the future is company boards to make these inherently ethical decisions for us. The opposite is you have some sort of governmental organization that do that, that has maybe more democratic legitimacy, but vastly less knowledge about how the business works and almost always gets the regulation, creates regulatory frameworks that have all kinds of unintended consequences and inefficiencies, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's a whole conversation for not only just 1 hour, but for days and days. So let's move back to the framework for a second here.
Yeah.
So you have the three columns. So value proposition, value architecture, and then some measurement of the contributions that this will make. And then you have two sets of questions or dimensions or directions that are associated with value proposition and value architecture. So seven each. And for those of you paying attention, that's the 3.14, right? So seven questions for each and then three different pillars. So we are going to go through each of the questions because they're all, you just take our word for it, they're all brilliant. But what I wanted to know is, as I read through this, do you see this, and I think I know your answer now, do you see this as a way of these questions or these directions as a way of kind of generating interesting business models or a way of kind of better understanding existing business models?
So for us, the way we build it was really, again, coming back to this idea, how do we help people get ideas? How do we stimulate the creativity? So for us, the 14 directions are really a way for people to do a systematic exploration of potential things that they could do to either invent or reinvent their business model. So for us, it's really a creativity tool. And of course, we structured it in such a way because we think that structured brainstorming is much more efficient. But we always tell our students or participants that it gives you a nice way to question yourself. But come on, if at one point of time this gets you another idea, you don't need to be super systematic about the way you go through those 14 directions. Sure. So it's really, you know, it's really a way to stimulate people's creativity and to brainstorming and to ideate. That's really how we build it. And by the way, we called it, of course, it's also a play on the number pi. Right,
so course,
the 314. It's also 314 is an infinite and irrational number. So it's also you can do this several times. I mean, you should do this always, all the time. And also, it's not necessarily super rational. And we the same way. We don't guarantee that if you go through the 14 direction at the end, you will have tomorrow a great business idea. Right, for the same reason, it's also irrational in the sense that you can just use it as a way to stimulate your creativity and not as a tool that will get you to an end.
In that reason, it's really great because if you give somebody a blank piece of paper and say, be innovative, come up with something new that we can do, this is super hard. So, and you might be able to come up with ideas, but maybe you don't think about questions. I think of your approach. I don't know if you've read this book about the checklist revolution. It's all about the power of simple checklists to help us avoid basic mistakes and things like this. But it's kind of like a checklist in some ways of checking whether you've thought about the things for an existing idea. But it also, just to use the analogy, so it's not exactly a checklist, but it's kind of a process where if you go through the process, it helps you come to something that maybe you wouldn't have come to before. And I think that it does a really nice job of that. So again, I don't mean to be full of only praise, but I think this is a really interesting part of the book. And as a process going through, I've seen it work several times. So again, highly recommend it. Now let's go though back to a word that you said about ideate and ideation. A new word that's entered into our lexicon. You say, and it's interesting because you then, after you lay out the 3.14 model, The book turns to discussion about how firms can nurture business model innovation and nurture innovation in general. And some of this stuff will be familiar to people who read this topic, and some is a little, I think to me, it was a little more interesting. So you say there's five steps. So there's ideating, and then you capture the ideas, and then the challenge of selecting which ideas that you go forward with experimenting, and then how do you go from experimenting to deploying? Now, in some ways, I think the ideation part and the deploying part, there's a lot out there. And I think what you have in the book is great, but I didn't have any kind of like, oh, I've never seen that before.
I fully agree.
Okay. So when I look at the capturing, selecting, and experimenting, that's where I think that it gets a little bit interesting there. Because when I work with companies, that middle three, how do you capture the ideas, how do you select them, and how do you experiment them, seems to be the hardest thing to pull off. And it always kind of boils down to the following. You know, you get people into a room and you say, innovation is really important. They all say, yes, of course, it's really important. And then you say, here's this great method to come up with innovation. And you go through the process and they go, yes, that's great. Look at all these great ideas. And then you say, so how about in your life? And they say, you have no idea how much little time I have. I have no time to do this at home, or not at home, but in my real world. I don't have any budget sitting there in my budget line called experimentation. I don't have any kind of place where I can just go and start to play around. I don't have the FTEs to pull off of other things. And people say, stop working on this. I have so much work on my desk. I just don't have the budget. I don't have the resources. I can't do it. Oh, and by the way, we have what's called an innovation center in our business. That's their job. That's not my job. So do you see, is that what you see? Because you teach this specific topic. Does this sound familiar to you?
Of course. And I think this is always the pushback that you get about innovation and how innovation works. I've never heard about the company that doesn't say that innovation is their top priority. You know, it's like, we want to be more innovative. I've never seen a company saying we don't want to be innovative, right? So, but we also realize that it's difficult. And you know, the easy answer is, oh, let's get a bunch of 20 people into this innovation center. And, you know, they will be super disruptive and they will come up with the next business model. And then, you know, they're in a high part of the city and they're usually the walls are painted in pink, you know.
Exactly.
and they will come up with this great innovation. And we know this doesn't work, but it's a nice way for people to say, we are doing something about innovation, but we know it doesn't work. And that's also, by the way, why the full name of our approach is Odyssey 314. It's this idea of an odyssey, because when you do innovation, you know where you start, but you have no idea where you will eventually get it, right? And well, it's also because Hélène is half Greek, and so she thought that having Odyssey in the title was a nice way. But it's also this idea of innovation being an adventure. And, you know, coming back I will answer your question, but let me just also say this about the process. Sometimes people ask us, oh, that's an interesting methodology. How many companies were created or how many businesses were created from this approach? And I tell them with a lot of humility, I don't know, because I don't think that if you apply any given approach, you will necessarily come up with a super disruptive idea, because innovation is a long-term process and it's not a stage gate process. It's something that you first have to create a culture about innovation. And it's not just organizing a structured brainstorming session that will help you get those disruptive ideas. It's much more about creating a whole culture. And our approach, I think, contributes to this culture. But it's like, for me, it's like planting a seed, you know, and you will only see the results after a couple of months or years. And this is why when you take those steps from ideation, capturing, selecting, and when you look at it as a, you know, very strict process, you probably don't get out anything. I think it's much more a question of creating the right culture. And of course, people who have this, you know, push towards innovation, and then they tell you, I'm sorry, I don't have time, I don't have the money, I don't have people. This is when you realize that there is no culture for innovation in this organization. And sometimes the way the way I like to frame it is a very well-known way of framing innovation in general, is to say that you have to exploit your current business model. This is exploitation. And you will do some incremental innovation exploitation. You will adjust your business model as you go. And we will all do incremental changes to our business model as you go. And this is our daily work. Hmm. But at the same time, at the organizational level, you have to find a place where this, where exploration is happening, you know, and we know here again, now, there is a trade-off between exploitation and exploration. And the answer of having a team of 20 people looking in exploration, I think is not the right idea, right? How do you build the links between exploitation and exploration? How do you make sure that people understand that exploration is maybe not everybody's job in the organization, but that they should at one point of time contribute to exploration? And how do you build the links between exploitation and exploration? And this is a key question. And this is also called the ambidextrous organization, the idea that you can play with your right hand and your left hand, right with your right and left hand at the same time. How do you build this organization that is ambidextrous, that does exploitation and exploration? Because if you only focus on exploitation, you're not preparing for the future. And we know that exploration is not going to be profitable right away, you know. So how do you build this? And my colleague CM Juni has written this article. I really like it. I love the title of the article, which is create the next Uber and be profitable in 3 months, right? We know this is not going to happen. We know that it took, even if you look at Uber or Airbnb, it took those companies years and years before they actually made a profit, right? And so I think there is this tension in established firms where we say we need to innovate, but then let's be profitable because we measure it with the same KPIs as existing business. And this is not going to work.
Just to build on that, I most innovations fail. So if you go, let's look at the ROI on our innovation, a specific innovation, and it fails, you're like, okay, well, this was a waste of money. And exactly. And this is, as you said, it goes into the same metric. Asking about how many businesses have been created by the process, it's kind of like going, let's say you go into a hardware store and you pick up a hammer and you go to the salesperson, you say, okay, how many beautiful pieces of furniture have been made with hammers?
Your analogies are always great, Matt.
it's not the hammer is a tool, and it needs to be used. The magic of the tool comes with a combination of the tool and the user. And exactly. To say what if it was automatic, so if we could just put Odyssey 3.14 in there and then push play, and then out the end would come successful business models. Life would be easy, right? There'd be no competitive advantage at all. So exactly. It isn't, I have a really nice guitar, but when I play it, it sounds absolutely horrible. And when other people play it who know what they're doing, it sounds wonderful. So the guitar is useful for music creation, but it depends on who's playing it.
Exactly. And I would even tell you, we had this discussion before about how AI is going to, how AI is going to change business. And I think AI will be very good in ideating, but then when it comes to the process, capturing ideas, selecting ideas, experimenting ideas, then I think the human part will come in, or at least AI will help us ideating, but then the rest of the processes, again, it's very much linked to culture and to the soft part of the organization.
What's a company that you think gets this right? This ambidextrous, this kind of exploiting and exploring, who pulls it off, do you think?
Well, I think that's a very, very difficult question to answer. I think there is no perfect company in this, but
sure.
Definitely, I think all the more digital tech companies, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, of course, I think would probably be the companies that do this right. or at least that have this process. You know, this idea at Amazon of saying it's every day, day one, they encourage innovation. They have very strong processes on the exploitation side, but then they also trigger the creativity of their employees on their exploration side. So I think those companies are examples of companies that probably know how to manage this exploitation dilemma. And you know, even they fail, because when you look at what Apple has announced recently about the autonomous car, right? Mm. This was a huge experiment, right?
Sure.
And they decided to stop it at one point of time. And they probably realized that this was a mistake. But I'm sure that everything they developed, you know, a lot of things that they developed for the autonomous car that they will eventually not launch the car itself, but they have built so important competencies that they can reuse for something else. So this is also the idea with experimentation. I think very often companies, the reason why innovation fail in established companies is that they are stopped too early, mm-hmm. right? When they haven't found a market yet. And then you say, oh, this business is not profitable, let's stop it. Imagine Uber, if they had stopped it after 2 years, the company wasn't profitable after it took them 15 years, right? So it's also about stopping. And so this is why this experimentation piece is so difficult, because you have to run experiments as you run a scientific experiment. That is, you need to have hypotheses that you want to test. And too often, I think now companies have understood the power of testing and experimentation. They have understood the logic behind it, but then they just throw out an idea, they test something, but they don't measure what they don't measure it. And then they say, oh, I'm not really sure if this succeeded or failed, right?
Yeah.
So you have to have a real process in experimentation and then give it time. And that's so difficult, because if you again measure it with conventional profitability tools, then you will kill it.
Right? Yeah.
You will kill it.
No, and I think, I mean, maybe you mentioned these newer tech companies. Maybe that it's because they're closer to the experience of converting an exploration into an exploitation, because they're just newer. And I think that if you, let's take automotive companies. So at one point, you know, when automobiles were being kind of invented and we were developing the internal combustion engine, super explorative. And then
yes.
you add on 80 years, 90 years of incremental exploitation, and then that becomes really hard. It's difficult to have that direct link, unlike, say, a Google or an Amazon that can say, oh, we came up with these great ideas and now we're multi-billion dollar firms. So
exactly.
that's a well we want to keep going back to see if we can come up with the new idea. Mm.
And of course, maybe also in those digital firms, you can do things, very simple things like a landing page, or you can, you know, probably
super easy to experiment.
Super easy.
Yep.
Versus in more industrial settings where it's much more expensive.
Just a small plug, what I spend a lot of time with companies on that very thing. You know, look, if you believe in this experimentation, you have to take the time to learn what experimental design means.
Exactly.
What's the importance of a control group? How do you look at interrupted time series, et cetera, et cetera? You can't just say, oh, an experiment's just putting together a pilot. You know, you have to be super careful in the way you design something. It costs the same.
Yep.
But if you don't design it well, you're just going to get kind of nonsense out. And so the design is everything. So that's a whole nother discussion.
Yep.
Look, I want to be respectful of your time, and I want to get to our last topic, because we're going to come off a little bit of the book. And again, I recommend it to everybody. I think it's a fantastic kind of approach, but also a way of connecting what we think about as a kind of cutting edge academic and theoretical work with what's happening in real companies. And so, again, highly recommend it. I'm going to turn, because You're one of the most talented teachers and academic directors I know that works in the executive education space. And we've worked together in this space for a while. And I want to ask you some questions about that industry. And what, to do this, I want to think about putting ourselves not in the supply side, but in the demand side. So you and I are in the business of creating content and supply for executive education. And you can think that this kind of can fall into three different categories. One is a kind of classic degree program. So we both work on Trium. This is an executive MBA. There's lots of very good executive MBAs out there. That's one thing. So this is kind of a degree program. Then you have kind of non-degree or open enrollment programs. So this might be something like the advanced management program at Harvard or a specific topic program. You pick up an open enrollment program at NYU or at HEC and you do 3 days of strategy or something like this. And then there's this whole bucket called customized corporate education. And this is usually done in consultation or in a kind of partnership with a business school like HEC. Sometimes it's completely internal to a company, but often you bring in a business school to help you with this. And this is something that's bespoke, a kind of usually a multi-residential module program, bespoke to the needs of a specific company. Now, again, I want you and I to go on a little journey, maybe an odyssey, over to the buy side today. So what advice would you give to an individual executive who says, I want to continue to learn, I want to continue to develop, I've got these things that I can do. What advice would you give to them as far as, should I do a degree? Should I go to open program? Should I push to get onto my custom corporate education? What advice would you give to an individual who's on the buy side?
I think it's not a question of choosing which program is the best for you, but it's, why do you want to do this? And if someone is interested in learning, which I think they should be, that's the first step. And so the question is, how do I best enhance my learning, and how do I make sure I can learn something that is worthwhile for me? And I think any of the programs that you mentioned will contribute to this, right? And to put yourself into this learning, this idea that you can't just, you know, learn once, that you go away, you go to school, back to school, and then you come out, and this doesn't work. I mean, it's all about long life learning. And I would argue that beyond the programs that you mentioned, you also have the podcast, the magazines, the books, and all this that are a full range of things, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so the question would be more, how will you take the time to learn? And again, podcasts and books and all this are super interesting because you can do it at home and or in your car or wherever. But it's this idea, what is the most important is to step back, you know, to be able to step back and to think and to reflect about your learning. How do you become a reflective practitioner? That is someone who thinks about what happened and how I can learn from what happened. You know, I always use this analogy with jazz players, that why do jazz players improve over time is that during the concert, they listen. So this is reflection in action. And then when they go home at night, they also have this reflection on action, that is what happened during the concert that I can learn and that I can bring in next time in the process. So how can you become this learning leader, this reflective leader? And at one point of time, I think you will need either program to help you step back and to take this time more, to take more time to step back and to reflect. And either of the program that you mentioned would do. This is, by the way, why we now more and more have programs. You know, you can start with an open enrollment and then they can transfer into a degree program, because we have realized at HSC that a lot of people don't necessarily want to take a degree program right away, which I can also understand, but they are interested in learning, but they're not sure that this is really what they want to dedicate a lot of time with. So you can start with an open program or with a customer's program in your organization and then go for a degree program. It's all about, you know, it's not a one shot. I think it's all about how to become this learning leader that you need to be. So you have the classic degree program, the open enrollment, and the customized, and I think all of them will answer some questions, some specific learning needs. What is nice with customized, it's that it's for your company, but then you only meet people from your own company, right?
Yeah.
What is nice with classic degree programs or open enrollment is that you also meet people from other industries. And as educators, we know that the learning not only comes from the professor, but also from the learning of the participants themselves in the program.
I completely agree with what you just said. And one of the things that I think about, you know me well enough that I always think about in stories and analogies. So the thing is, there is a lot of stuff out there, podcasts, books. Yes. It's not in a way, it's kind of like there's no lack of content out there for people. And if everybody was super self-disciplined and they could, in a way, get a lot of content just for free or for not very much money at all. So two things I think that about that. If you're that type of person and you're only interested in the content, congratulations. But most of us, it's more like, and here I'm going to go back, Hélène would appreciate this maybe, it's like Ulysses and the Sirens, right? And so for those of you not knowledgeable of this particular story, Ulysses is on a trip across the known world and he's having adventures and he hears about these beautiful women that are on this small island. And nobody, the problem is when you get near the island, the sirens start to sing this song that seduces the person to sail their vessel towards the island and they crash on the rocks and everybody dies. So no one, the idea is no one has ever kind of heard the siren song and survived. Now that leaves a question open, of course, how do we know that the siren song is so wonderful, but we'll just skip that for now. So what Ulysses decides, look, I want to listen to this. I want to have done this, but I don't want to die. So he has all of his crew put in earphones and he lashes himself to the mast of the ship. And he says, I don't care what I say, what I do, don't untie me. And they sail near to the island and he hears the song. And so he goes mad. He says, let me go. We need to go see these people, but he can't do it. So I think sometimes signing up to a degree program or a non-degree program is like lashing ourselves to the mast, because it means that we're going to do it. We're going to sit there and we're going to do it because now we've paid the money, we're going, we've invested it, we're going to be in this location and we might as well do it. And then suddenly it kind of forces yourself to act in your kind of long-term best interest. And so in a way,
I love your analogy, Matt. I think it's a wonderful analogy.
Sometimes I think that's the case. And plus, of course, it's learning from other people. So you can read and listen as much as possible, but you aren't going to get that same interaction. Now I'm going to switch the question a little bit here, because again, we're on the supply side of the custom programs. So, you know, The way this business works, for those of you who don't know, a company will put out a request for a quote they'll either invite certain business schools to respond for their customized programs internal to the company, or it'll be an open response. They'll just publish the request for a quote or request for a proposal openly and anybody can apply. And I often think to myself, if I was on the buy side of this process. So I then, again, for those of you who don't know, then there's a scramble. The school puts together a team, they respond to the RFP, they make the presentation, and it's an open competition about who's going to get the contract. And I often think, gosh, what would it be like to be on the buy side? What would I be looking for? So what advice would you give to a company? So if they're on the buy side in corporate customized programs, what would you want to make sure that's in the description of the program, and what would you want to discover through the selection process?
I think, and again, it's putting ourselves in the shoes of our customer, right?
But sure.
I think, again, what we want to have is that we want to make sure that the participants that go through the program, they really learn something from it. But it's not so much about learning about business models or strategy or innovation. Is that they develop this curiosity that will help them build a different culture about innovation, a different culture about whatever the program is about. And this takes time. And so what I would look at is how you build not only an amazing learning journey for the participants during the program, but also how this will stick, how the learning will stick, and how the learning will transform this person to give him or her the tools to transform the organization towards the goal that is set in the program. And this is not easy to measure, right? Because you can measure the satisfaction at the end of the program and so on, but this doesn't guarantee. You can have very happy participants that don't change at all, right? So you can, how do you measure this? And so I think I would challenge the way we measure the success of a program. And it's not only about evaluation at the end of the program or at the end of the session, but it's really 6 months, one month, 1 year later, what has it changed for you as a leader for your team and for the organization? And I think this is what I would pay attention to. How do you develop this curiosity to think that people go on learning on their own? And how do you instill this? But that's very, very difficult to measure. I think that's the main one.
Yeah, it's super difficult. I mean, I'm sure you've had these conversations with clients where, you know, sometimes you're asked, you know, what's going to be my return on the investment on the learning? And so then we're back to this idea of how do you measure things that have different metrics? So, you know, how do you measure a more curious, engaged, passionate, global oriented, better, you know, of course it has to go to performance at some point, but it might be long term. You don't, then you have the counterfactual. You don't know what this person would have done without the training.
Exactly.
But then I think it's a legitimate question on the side of our buyers.
It is.
How much should I invest in this? Right.
It is.
Am I investing too little? Am I investing too much? How do I know what I should do? Because it's easy to write the check and send people along, but then, you know, how do I know that I'm doing the right thing? So I think it's really tricky on the buy side. I have fantasies about being on the buy side sometimes. I think it would be fun to ask, you know, kind of nasty questions. But I do think they have a hard job.
And I think one of the things we can do is measure, you know, before with a 360, before and after. But again, this only measures certain types of things. It's not really obvious how to measure this. What I see very often, I think it's also the time the CEO or someone from top management spends at the end of the program with the participants. If you really want to show that this is important and this is not just a, you know, a buy-side program, then you have to involve top management, and it should be a priority for top management. But of course, it's difficult because it requires a lot of time.
I want to be respectful of your time. I know you have other important things to do. So I have one final question for you. We ask this question at the end of each of our podcasts. What's a book, film, play, piece of music, podcast, anything that you recommend to the audience? Something you've consumed in the last year, fiction, nonfiction, serious, not serious? What do you think?
I think maybe I would recommend a documentary on Netflix that is called Breaking Boundaries, and that explains the planetary boundaries in a very, very nice way. I think the documentary is very well done. It's backed by scientific knowledge, and it gives us a very good understanding of what is happening out there and the challenges we will be facing. And again, one of the reasons I think this is important is that we need to reinvent our business models to face those challenges. The better we understand the challenges, the better we'll be able to reinvent our business models.
Fantastic. Laurence, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt. And as always, I love those conversations with you. And I'm happy to be able to share this one with others because they're always very dear to me. So thank you.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Triumn Connects, a podcast for the Triumn community. I'm Matt Mulford, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure to keep an eye out for the announcement of the next episode of Triumn Connects. Until then, I wish you all the very best.